Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's world service.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's the persuasion of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
The secret to any great Six Nations rivalry, much like in boxing, is the two protagonists
straight up don't like each other.
Doesn't matter that one of them keeps beating the other one time and time again. As long as there is a mutual antipathy there, I will be tuning in. And that's how it goes with Ireland versus Scotland this Saturday. Hey, Ciarán.
Hey, Owen, how's it going?
Nice sip of water there?
Yeah, it was good. I'd like to stay hydrated throughout my broadcasting. The last thing anyone wants to hear is that, you know, like a dry lip.
Yeah, it's true. I'll tell you the first thing anyone wants to hear today, Murph. And that is Gregor Townsend slagging our boys off last year in the Netflix documentary Full Contact.
Over the last few years, I've heard a lot of things come out of Ireland. The Irish players, the Irish media, believe we're soft. Believe we're the team that's going to go for 60 minutes and then fade. That is not happening. We win. We have been building to a performance that delivers the best of us. And the best of us beats any team in the world.
It's really weird the way he puts that music on behind him when he's talking to doing his team talks.
I'd be like,
it's the really dramatic music.
Gregor, honestly, it seems like you're talking sense here, but I can barely hear you with the string section that have told themselves directly behind
by
you.
By the way, great job, guys. Round of applause,
yeah,
everybody,
well,
for the
well
string
done,
section.
The percussion is absolutely top class, but I'm actually just I'm at the back here with Schumann. I'm having difficulty actually hearing your advice here.
Come halftime, Gaffer. Last season, Gregor was reinforcing his messaging.
I've never been more confident you guys winning this game. You've got them up front. We're going to hammer them all, hammer them the scrum, and hammer them the contact. And we're fitter, so we make that fitness count, and we're winning this game.
Yeah, okay, we don't need to give the full-time score. You know, people get the
And certainly it would be churlish of me to mention the fact that we had, you know, Josh van der Fleer throwing out the line-out for a large portion of the half that followed that speech.
Listen, that
but again,
passing.
Listen, that's not...
Hoggy got in to say anything from Hogg?
We're due these fuckers one, but we're going to lift the triple crown. We're going to have a shit ton of fun doing it. So.
Shit ton of fun.
It's a Stuart Hogg approach to rugby. Just win. Well, often don't win, but have
lose
a shit ton of fun.
Lose with
it.
A smile on your face is the Stuart Hogg way.
Tadhg Byrne was asked this week. I don't know if you saw these quotes, Murph. Didn't actually manage to sneak them into you during today's podcast. He was asked if he was surprised by anything he saw on Full Contact. Not really, no, he said. The Scots are the Scots. We have our perception of them, and I'm not going to verbalise it here because they've given us ammo in the past from what they've said in the media, and I'd be surprised if it was any different this week. That's way further than most people go when asked about them.
Yeah.
They straight up do not like each other, these two.
They really don't.
Yeah, we had the Irish Independent's Rory O'Connor in studio.
Fascinating to listen to the kind of discourse around the team, to read what people have said, even listening to the camp on Tuesday was one of the most interesting Tuesday pressers that we get in Abbottstown, because Simon Easterby fairly just picked through the bones of it a little bit, gave us a window into the video review. I would take it on a fairly even keel. I think if they lose this weekend, I think all of our impressions of this Irish team would change utterly, whereas right now I think they're a good team who played badly, you know, and still managed to get to the end. But I think it's been fascinating. They're such an interesting team when they lose, because we see it so infrequently, and what England had to do to get them into that position is just really interesting.
Plus the people who hate rugby really hate it in Ireland, and these losses, particularly to England, just energise them. I mean, it's kind of a fascinating, we get great feedback on
it. Yeah, but actually, a lot of the emails that we were just reading out there don't seem to be...
They're the other side as well,
necessarily
yeah.
hate the rugby team or want them to lose, but I have one here for you from Killian Devlin, and I think this actually alludes to something that Simon Easterby spoke about on Tuesday. It was the decision to box there to kick for Conor Murray to kick the ball away near the end. Why does nobody believe in our ability as the best team in the world to hold possession for 90 seconds when we have a numerical advantage? It's an image we've seen time and time again where we've kicked it away. The other team either wins it, New Zealand, on the first near miss, or Tadhg Byrne has to save the day with a poach. It needs to be challenged as a concept. The enduring image of most of the New Zealand tight wins is Aaron Smith controlling a few slow phases, watching the clock turn red and casually ending the game with a kick and a fist pump. Time to challenge this doctrine. Show us the stats. Cheers from Killian.
Yeah, like, it's an interesting point, because a lot of the, when I've heard this discussed this week, a lot of people have said there's no other team in the world who would have kept the ball in that position. But if you're supposed to be the best team in the world, well, you should be coming up with innovative approaches to think your way through these situations. So it used to be talked through it really well in terms of what they...
Well, they aren't the best team in the world, though. Just
but they're one of the best teams in the world. I think they see themselves as the best team in the world. And I think that maybe was part of the problem.
That's the point that I did make that point on Monday. But Murphy's left the studio at the moment. He would probably say that... If we wanted to be considered the best team in the world,
but Rory's point was that they aspire to be and therefore should be thinking more innovative.
Yeah, like if the doctrine globally, if every rugby team in the world is kicking the ball off and trusting their defence, and when you have had the best defence in the tournament, it's reasonable to think that you could defend, and their defence was terrible. Like that's the reason this kick is so important is because their defence off the line out was terrible. So you're basically doing what you're not supposed. So if you see yourself as different, then why are you doing what everyone else will do? If England are set up for the kick, well, then there's space in the front line. So could they have flashed it across to low and kind of surprised England in the way that Leinster did against Toulouse in 2006? You know, when they went from inside door 22 or something like that. Now, if that had gone wrong, the emails that we like, it would have been cavalier. The feedback would have been even worse. Like, no matter
what. Fairness, this emailer isn't calling for it to be spun out or anything fancy. He's talking about just up the jumper, one out runners.
Maybe that email wouldn't be the one who's emailing him in because he thinks that we should be that Ireland should be able to do that. And if it goes wrong, take the consequences. You knock on, you lose, you know, scrum penalty. Marcus Smith kicks the winner. Like, at the time, I thought it was the right decision personally. But maybe that's because I'm so enslaved by the doctrine as well. But, you know, it seemed like the percentage call. Like, Murray had watched James Lowe's big, massive boots being run back at Ireland all day. It's where England got their first two tries from. Keeping on the pitch is just so inherently risky, particularly if your policy is to try and run down the clock from that far out. It's not going to work. Like, the ref will give a penalty against you because you'll eventually go off your feet at a breakdown.
But we're not talking about like it's 4 or 5 minutes like it felt like Munster had to do for the Heineken Cup years ago. It's just a minute or so.
Murray Ginsler made the point during the week that I think the average rugby possession is 15 seconds. So you're asking to keep the ball for an awful long time. I think you're going to have to kick at some stage. Whether they could have gone through one or two more or mauled it, delayed it a little bit more, there's definitely an argument for that. I don't think the execution was good.
I know Lowe's long kicks didn't go that well either.
Yeah, and that makes England... attack from much deeper, or if Murray gets a better kick on it, they have to go from further back. But the way Ireland defended it, you know, like, there was no reason for Ireland to give up the try in the way that they did. I'm still grappling myself with why they were so poor in that moment. They were passive off the line, they went for the choke, and the choke itself is not a bad decision, but the fact that four or five of them stood around watching. And it wasn't the only time in the game where they were caught kind of as spectators. Like, James Lowe's kind of almost half celebrating as the ball starts coming out. And Emmanuel Fayebosu actually said, I don't know where their winger had gone, but when I saw Aki, I went for it. So, like that was a... There was a, not to put it all on Lowe, but, like, the whole team's decision-making and actions in the reaction to that were so poor that I have a feeling that if Ireland kicked it anywhere in the pitch, they were still going to cough it up because they were gone at that stage.
Just be honest, also, Easterby made it clear that this was a coaching decision. That this was because there was time to make the call. There was
sent the message down. The
message
field,
was sent on. I mean, presumably, Johnny Sexton's not there anymore. Maybe Sexton would have said that's the wrong call. I don't know. Conor Murray's got tons of experience.
I think if you had Sexton here, he'd say it was the right call. I think that's the way they would approach that.
It's very hard to say no to what your coach has just told you.
Sure.
But your head's fairly scrambled.
But is this not the whole point about great rugby teams, especially Andy Farrell's team, that unlike Joe Schmidt, he's given the players more license to feel their own way into games and to make calls on the pitch and all that kind of stuff.
But the depth of the decision went down to the fact that...
I feel like I'm taking Murph's role here.
The depth of the decision goes down to the fact that, and Easterby said this, that Theo Dan was on the pitch for England and he's only ever thrown the ball into a line-out internationally for three or four times. He's really inexperienced, so they felt like if they got it off, they could get pressure on. They didn't get pressure
on. We didn't even lift, did we?
I think they tried to, but they just slipped. Or they because it was a four-man, and they've struggled on four-mans for some reason. Yeah. I think the decision itself is not the issue. It's the reaction to that line-out. the way they reacted to it, I just feel like no matter what they would have done, if they try and play their way out or kept the ball, they would have dropped it. If they kicked it long, their chasing line would have been bad all day. They would have had a bad chasing line. England would have made the gains. They didn't manage it well enough to trust them in that moment, because I do trust them as a team, but they were very uncharacteristically off it on Saturday. I think no matter what Murray had done or who had kicked it or what they had done, they would have found a way to foul it up, and England were just so dominant. And I don't believe in destiny, but like they do, England just went and won the game, whereas Ireland were almost trying not to lose it.
You mentioned the line out there. On the Ireland line out, David McCarthy emails in, if Paul O'Connell wasn't a legend of Irish rugby, people would be calling for his head, much like people were giving out about Mike Catt as Irish attack coach before he turned it around. The lack of questioning about his performance as a forwards and line outs coach is example number 44,785 of the Irish rugby media not doing their job and instead looking after their mates. Are you mates with Paul O'Connell?
I would like to be mates with Paul O'Connell. He's a very engaging character, but no, I
he
can't
keeps saying
to
no.
Me. I asked him after the. Sorry, I heard you discuss it on Monday. You're members of the Irish the wider Irish.
Well,
media.
The email also says that Ken was afraid to criticise Paul O'Connell, which I don't think Ken's afraid to criticise Paul. I brought it up as though, you know, it's Paul O'Connell, Ken. He's the guy in charge of the line out, you know. And now there is a joke aside. We talked about it a few weeks ago as well. To be fair, before this tournament, after the World Cup, that I think. There's one difference, obvious difference in the Mike Catt. Sorry, my point that I was going to raise was that I agree that people are just naturally going to give Paul O'Connell more leeway than Mike Catt.
I think that's it.
Like an Irish rugby legend, an Irish sporting icon is going
to
get
and
that.
And to Irish-born rugby players.
Somewhat consciously and somewhat subconsciously. The other point about it is Mike Catt was coming in without any sort of sterling reputation for his work with England. It wasn't like we were all delighted to get him and then... not sure. It's like he was coming in with question marks over him anyway, and things weren't going well. There was no body of work that we could point to. Whereas O'Connell actually did have a very highly functioning line out and forward unit for a long time, kind of up until the World Cup warm ups.
Mm. Well, he fixed what was
exactly
a malfunctioning.
So he has got a body of work with Ireland to bite back at that one.
No, absolutely. Like it is legitimate to question and criticise Ireland's line out. It's not a disastrous line out. It's not like Munster over Christmas when they had no hookers and they weren't winning anything. They're operating in and around 80%, which they would look at and go, is okay, but they could get better. I asked O'Connell about it in the mix zone after the World Cup quarterfinal. He gave a very measured and reasoned and intelligent response, as you'd expect. And I think part of the reason he does get, I was going to say a pass, I don't think he gets a pass as such, but I think people have, the part of the credit that he has in the bank is that everyone knows how intelligent he is, how impressive he is. And we know
how obsessive he is.
That he's putting the work in. They select a forward pack, I think, based on what they can do around the pitch and not what they can do in the set piece. They value the set piece, but I do think there have been kind of times where kind of a scrummaging lock or a scrummaging prop may not have made it because their passing wasn't good enough. I think
Joe McCarthy is an example.
Joe McCarthy, yeah, absolutely. Like, Joe McCarthy is a brilliant lifter, but he's not going to ever call a line out. So you have Tadhg Byrne calling the line out at a very late stage of his career, but he hasn't done it a lot at international level. But there was James Ryan lost his place at the World Cup because Henderson was calling the line out better. But Ryan's probably, well, they're both very good footballers, but I think Ryan had been ahead of him the whole way through. I don't know if there's an obsessive, like Devin Toner took the mantle of the line-out obsessive off Paul O'Connell. I don't think there is one in that camp right now. I think if Ryan Baird or someone wants to make themselves indispensable, you go and that's what you make that your point of difference. But like Borthwick, like the line-out nerds are quite specific people. Like Borthwick is known, like if you say Steve Borthwick's name, one of the things you'll say about him is he's a line-out nerd. O'Connell was like that. Like, yes, it's part of your job and you would expect them to be obsessive to some degree about it, but I think there are lads who go a little bit extra. Not this, like Ireland, I think before this last game had scored 14 of their last 15 tries off their line-out. They scored two off the line-out, one off a scrum last weekend. I can't quite recall, but they scored the vast majority off their line-out. So when it goes wrong, it's really
one
alarming.
Of them, yeah. So should have been two Maul tries against New Zealand. Scored one of them, the other held up.
Yeah, although the accepted wisdom is that if Jordy Barrett hadn't held up Rowan Gallagher, Ireland would have won that game. The one bit of revisionist history I've been doing this week is that, well, Ireland did get ahead with 6 minutes to go in this game and they didn't close it out at all. So what would have happened in the end? Like, we all assumed that they would have held on in that game, but I'm not so sure anymore because we saw what happened and we've seen it with the Leinster-La Rochelle games, which I think play into the overall perception of this team. There's a bit of work to do. And like 2 years ago, Ireland lost in Paris when Joey Carby started at 10 and Andy Farrell talked about the team as being the team being frazzled away from home. And I thought they'd fixed it in New Zealand. And at the World Cup, they weren't really away from home. There was 60, 70% crowds in Irish favour.
Possibly better
than this was probably the most intimidating atmosphere Ireland have faced since that night in Paris. Mm. And I thought they were a little bit frazzled in the face of that atmosphere. And maybe that's where Sexton was missing.
I think the reason this England loss has fired people up so much is the nature of it, those last few seconds. And that's what the majority of our feedback was about, those last couple of minutes and how Ireland managed it. And that it's this repeat situation where Ireland can mangle teams, are an absolutely brilliant rugby team by any measure. But when it comes to the clutch against a good team, they haven't done it when it really matters.
They have.
And Leinster too.
They have, though, because they beat South Africa in a pool game, but in a clutch situation, you know, that last,
when you need
that mass
to
mall.
Win it.
Well, the series win in New Zealand, they that was, you know, Tyburn comes up, I think the emailer referenced that Tyburn comes up with a massive turnover in that game. In one-off games, they have won close one-off games.
Yeah.
And I don't equate last Saturday, I know the Grand Slam was on the line, but I think the World Cup quarter-final was the most high pressure environment those players will ever play until they get to the next one, especially with the history, because we never won one before. They all thought they were going to win it. But I think there is definitely a trend of big games that these players have been in, and the end, it's come down to the end game and it hasn't gone their way. I think the two La Rochelle ones they were ahead and they lost the squander winning position. So I think they're more of a keeping with this one. The New Zealand one, it was the start that killed them, because at the end, and I know what I've said, what I just said, but like, they were the aggressors in the end game in that game, and they didn't quite manage it. I think this is slightly different in that they were in control. Well, they were never in control in the game, but they were in control on the scoreboard, and they squandered that control, and they kind of went into themselves in those last 90 seconds. And that's where you'd be worried about. I don't think they'll be in that place this weekend. Yep. I think that the two test tours of South Africa this summer will take them to places like that, will be really good for the team's development. And it might not be a great tour, you know, based on what we've just seen. And, you know, this might be a bit of pain before they can grow again. But
Rassie talking about righting wrongs and,
you know,
his record against Ireland. Just, you know, the way he speaks with that kind of quiet menace, big smile on his face, but scary stuff. I don't know. I just have a feeling he's talking about, you know, building the squad and all that this week, and how, yeah, we're going to get rid of some of the old lads, bring in the young lads, but actually first, kill Ireland.
One word we've barely mentioned in this conversation, lads, so far is, I mean, we're already looking forward to the tour to South Africa. There's a country called Scotland coming to town. Hopefully the team are paying more attention to Scotland than the rest of us seem to be.
I think it's natural, again, when they lose, that the defeat seeps into the week. And like, even at Tuesday's press conference, you know, it was nearly all about what had happened the previous weekend, and I think the fact that there's a championship on the line was what Andy Farrell was definitely spinning in his post-match stuff, I'd say in the dressing room as well, while I'm sure the review was fairly cutting. But I think in the immediate aftermath, it goes like, lads, we've lost the game by a point, but next week we can go and do something. So I think within the camp, yeah, they're definitely focused in on Scotland. And even if they're focusing in on the defeat, they're probably channeling it into a performance, because they know they let themselves down to a degree, and they really don't like Scotland. I would, you know, they probably hate Scotland, really. If you got them honestly on Saturday night after a few pints, they'd tell
why,
you.
Why would I hate Scotland?
Well, just the two teams, just like, if you watch the Netflix documentary, yeah. Scotland, I mean, I know the team stays stuff in the build up to games, but like, the way they talk about Ireland is so, it's just, I've been hearing behind the scenes, the Scottish players over the last couple of years, particularly in the Glasgow Munster thing, that the Scottish players just don't rate the Irish players and don't understand why they win all the trophies and they don't. And they kind of go into these games with like this sense of like, we're going to do it this time because it's going to come right in the end. And then up till now, it's never happened. And the Irish players understand that, and they keep beating them, and the Scottish keep talking about the media. And you probably read Tyke Burns' comments during the weekend.
Well, actually, can I just kind of give that? Yeah. So, and because we played some of the clips from
Hoggy and Townsend.
Hogg and Townsend from Full These Contact. Fuggers. But what did Tyke Burns say? The Scots are the Scots. Good phrase. We have our perception of them, and I'm not going to verbalise it here because they've given us ammo in the past from what they've said in the media, and I wouldn't be surprised if it was any different this week. So that's way more than a player normally says about an opponent's team.
Yeah, sometimes it's not, you know, it's the
we have,
you
know, our perception of
said.
Them.
Yeah, like, and you could see that in the World Cup game, you know, when there was the big row with Schoeman throwing Dan Sheehan over the hoardings. Like, they generally don't. I think there's a England and Ireland, they battle it out. There's generally a fairly good relationship. I think all of the all of the teams apart from Ireland and Scotland but have pretty decent off-field relations, or it doesn't seep into it. But
yeah, because I know Gatty has said before that Wales hate Ireland more than any other
nation.
That was
a while ago, though.
And then I've heard the players under Gatty say, what are you talking about, Gatty? We quite like them.
I think until the 2009 Lions tour, that rivalry was like this, and it was really spiky, and like the Ospreys were good, and this goes down to Munster Glasgow games, Leinster Glasgow in the final a couple of years ago, where they thought Rob Kearney was sent off. Even Munster Edinburgh, like there have been flashpoints in these two countries' relationships.
Munster Glasgow
and Edinburgh.
Oh, Edinburgh.
Ty Byrne was accused of diving after beating Edinburgh in a game in Murrayfield about 5-6 years ago, and then they made a meal out of that as well. So there's this relationship is not particularly good, but it's healthy for the game, because like for many Irish people, Scotland are a bit of an irrelevance, but for the team, they're the team they love beating. And I mean, Peter O'Mahony made that clear in the aftermath of the pool game, when he kind of threw Blair Kinghorn's comments back in his face. So
what was that one again?
Kinghorn had said they'd been on a winning run for a while, but we're going to end that, or something along those lines. And then O'Mahony in his post-match goes, well, we've been reading during the week that they're going to end our winning run. Well, that went well for them, didn't they? And he kind of walked off, kind of mic drop moment. So like this, Ireland are not masking their contempt for Scotland, and Scotland, you know, used the biggest streaming platform in the world to show the world
how much this stuff still matters. I know Ben Earl has referenced it immediately post match, name checked Jamie Heaslip in his podcast with the BBC this week.
Oh, that's it. So since then, post match.
And then all the Ireland Scotland stuff. And then if you think about post Ireland New Zealand, all the talk was what O'Mahony said on the tour of New Zealand about being a
but of course this is always. I don't see why this doesn't surprise people.
The deeper we get into pro rugby, it's pro sport.
This stuff, of course.
I'm aware of one.
Like Man City, you could tell how pissed off those players were about what Trent Alexander-Arnold said. They were queuing up. Now, if they'd won, they would have been even more bullish. But they were queuing up afterwards before and after that match against Liverpool to say, well, he doesn't know what it's like to win a treble.
But it's not making a slight difference. It pulled out the greatest performance of Kane's career, and probably the best of Ben Earl's as well.
Yeah, like I think
it's not just like a 2%.
They were well prepared as well, but I think the definitely helped with the emotional pitch. I think we underestimate the media sometimes. Like I'm aware of one professional coach who gets back on the bus, and the first thing he did was kind of flick past the match report and straight onto the comments and read everyone in the readers' comments on the bus from the match to the hotel. Right. Like everything is read, and they're completely aware of everything that's been said about them. And sometimes they use it for fuel, sometimes it gets on top of them, sometimes, you know, it's a massive part of the sport, and it was definitely a factor. Like I think England, this was a game that England had earmarked from way out. I think Jones, Borthwick built a game plan for Ireland. And both of them are really like kind of seen as being quite like nerdy in a good way, and they put all of their energies into figuring out Ireland, and they built over the course of this window to produce that performance, and the emotion definitely helped, and the emotional pitch they got to from the off was so impressive to watch. And again, for Ireland to handle that, the most impressive thing about Ireland's performance last weekend was that they somehow lived with them. I think there's not many teams in the world who would have been going into that game ahead and a couple of points up and would only lose by a point, because England brought so much to the stuff that didn't realise they had.
I don't know how much praise there is there, though. Like Ireland were massive favourites beforehand.
Absolutely,
everyone assumed they were going to win by loads,
and
then they end up just because they didn't lose by that much.
I think the odds and everything were based largely on how bad England had been as well as how good Ireland had been, and England closed the gap within 80 minutes to a point where I think if they played this weekend, the odds would look very, very different. And I suppose we could all go off. But at the same time, they got themselves in the winning position and they lost it. That's where I would be very critical.
Yeah, we're going back to England again. It's happening again. Falling into that trap. I don't know if the Irish, or the Scottish public are as confident as their team is going to be this week. So you were talking to Tom English.
Yeah, Tom English, friend of the show, BBC, obviously, Scotland. He thinks Ireland will score 40 points against Scotland. He says there's trepidation, there's a bit of fear, not amongst the players now, but just the public and the media.
Should mention Thomas, obviously Irish. I'm not trying to say to Tom, but he's you know,
he straddles both.
He straddles both.
He's been in Scotland a long time.
So I wonder.
He understands the Scottish psyche. Let's put it that way.
That's last week's talk, isn't it? It's going to be a close game. We're all looking forward to a close game, a tight fair. None of us are getting burnt this week. But
Shane Horgan didn't see much jeopardy in this game. We spoke to him earlier in the week. I do.
I think that might have just been a wonder. Yeah, Shane's on today. The Monday after, you've been, next week doesn't matter. He is on version this weekend, so I presume he's going to have to change his tone there. match doesn't matter pre-match.
Yeah, the form lines are so weird. Like, Scotland beat the same English team by 9 points 2 weeks ago, and then go and lose to Italy, having kind of almost beaten France and finding a way to lose that game, and had a weird, like, they've been, I suppose, typically Scottish in terms of their inconsistency over this tournament. Ireland have played poorly in one game. I think Ireland probably have, they've had one really good performance. I think they've been coasting along a little bit through the other two. They beat two, well, Italy are not a poor team, but they played poorly that day. I think Italy came over already just not, knew they weren't going to get anything out of the game. Wales are basically an under 20 side. Like, you know, they're not a full, you know, they're not a full rugby team, and they caused Ireland a couple of problems, which maybe should have tempered all of our expectations
in the line
making them. And they probably showed England a couple of things, but and then we've had England. So I wouldn't be massively stressed about this weekend, but I do think Ireland need to perform. I think anything less than a performance would invite Scotland in, and we all remember Croke Park in 2010. Like, you know, Scots do like being underdogs and they do like spoiling parties. So
we're back to a 5-3 split on the bench with Ringrose back involved in the squad.
Yeah, well, Frawley's injury, Frawley hasn't recovered in time. I think that means it's harder to go 6-2, especially if you want to leave Crowley at 10. You could pick Harry Byrne on the bench and then move Crowley if he has to come on. But I think the fact that you have Gary Ringrose there, the fact that you've lost Frawley, it makes some sense. It's probably harsh on Ian Henderson, who I know he gave away the penalty that ultimately leads to the kind of end game, but he also had a big role in creating the try. He was up for media on Tuesday for some reason, which is unusual for a player who's put up on a Tuesday to be left out. Mm-hmm. But I think it's probably sensible in terms of getting the kind of right combinations onto the 23 to get Ringrose in there. And but I think probably the biggest thing is that he stuck with the 15. You know, like they didn't play well. There's loads of them didn't play well. You know, and I think they know that. And they've earned his trust over the course of the last couple of years to go again. But they wouldn't want to have another bad game because some of them are under big pressure for their places.
Yeah, I thought the two props did well. Mm. Like, our scrum was quite good. But Sheehan, as you say, McCarthy, Ty Byrne did fine. Darris had a terrible game on the rewatch. I didn't realise it the first time round. His tackling was poor on quite a few occasions. I just didn't really get involved, didn't carry. Van der Fleer was the best Irish player on the pitch. O'Mahony had one of his worst ever games for Ireland. Murray, O'Mahony, Sheehan maybe has more credit in the bank. And maybe O'Mahony, you're not going to drop him as captain in the final Six Nations game. But for Murray to keep his place on the bench, Joe McCarthy to keep his place, Sheehan maybe. Are you surprised there's no changes to the
Especially with a seven-day turnaround. I thought there was ample space for him to make two changes to his pack and kind of go, well, we wanted to freshen things up. So even publicly, he doesn't have to sound like he's dropping them. And you're right, it's very hard to drop your captain. Like, what it would say, it would basically end the Peter O'Mahony captaincy if they dropped him this week. It would put him in a very unfair position, albeit he's supposed to do what's best for the team. And Ryan Baird at the moment is a better player and has had a better tournament. And I think O'Mahony's in trouble, like, for a spot, I think, going to South Africa. And I wonder whether they'll do that transition between now and that tournament. But I was probably saying similar things about Johnny Sexton in 2020. And he proved me wrong, and he showed a longevity that I didn't expect. But in that position, just O'Mahony looked a little bit old on Saturday. Like, it was such a
Alternatives. There was very few alternatives to Sexton.
There's Baird, there's Jack Conlon could be playing there as well. You've also got Tom Ahern, who hasn't been capped yet, but it's very good. I thought you could have rotated Sheehan and Keller. I thought Keller was really good off the bench, and he's probably a better set piece forward. Like, going back to what I said earlier, you could have, you know, and they're both of a very, very high level. And also the impact, if you're not going 6-2, well, bringing Dan Sheehan on with 30 minutes to go, that's like bringing two forwards on. He was very slow to use the bench in Twickenham. I mean, that would be a criticism of Farrell that I'd have. So, I know it led to O'Mahony getting yellow carded just as he was supposed to come off. You know, like, that undermined the whole 6-2 split. I mean, going back to Twickenham again.
Calvin Nash, so as we are partially going back to Twickenham for this one, he went off with his HIA. He is back. I mean, I was about to say, is he allowed to play? Obviously, he is allowed to play. But what are the protocols there that you can go off with that on one Saturday and then be able to play the next Saturday?
Yeah, I think there was about 2022, they brought in this mandatory 12-day stand down period. And I think we all expected after that if a player left the field after a brain injury and a subsequent HIA, they wouldn't return. But there is a kind of a matrix of kind of decision making that goes called the HIA process. So what Nash would have done, and it's like Johnny Sexton between the first and second test in New Zealand in 2022, when this was a big story, and he played in both games. Nash would have done his HIA 1 pitch side, you're coming off. then within 3 hours they have to do HIA2. And if he is not showing any symptoms and is feeling okay, passing the tests that are benchmarked against previous tests that he's done, he then basically, if he fails at that point, he's out of the following week. But if he passes, he's got a possibility. So he goes to the next day, does HIA3. If he's still showing no symptoms and all that sort of stuff, he passes that. Then he's allowed to return to training on a gradual basis. So Monday would have been in bike work. Tuesday would have trained with the team, but probably not taking any contact. Wednesday, he would have probably been allowed to train fully, I think, if I'm getting it right. And at that point, Andy Farrell would have said, you're allowed to play. It's not a great look, I think, for a player to leave the field with a brain injury and be playing 7 days later. But Ireland do have a pretty good record when it comes to managing head brain injuries, and like they've stood down players for long periods, and I know they do take it seriously. So there's,
and Frawley is sitting this one out.
But then you have an English player, Emmanuel Feyobosu, who was one of the best players in the pitch last weekend, reported for training on Monday and said, actually, I've been feeling a bit groggy, and he self-reported a concussion that's been ruled out this weekend.
Progressive. That would never have happened a few years back.
Absolutely not. Now, he is a medical student, so he's fully aware, right. Fully aware of the dangers more than anyone. Like, you know, and I think we are at a point now where players can't claim to not have informed consent. Like, they all know. If they don't, they're just not they're actively not looking for it.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot of times, you say something on this show and you're like, jeez, you don't, that could come back to bite me in the arse now, you know? But like, I could just come out and say, what I like about the Scotland rugby team, you'll never ever get a chance to play audio back to me and be like, what were you thinking? How could you have come out and said such a thing?
Oh, Flood of Scotland.
You understand.
When will we see your like again?
Scotland are a disgrace to Wordsworth.
That fought and died for
the jobs.
Your wee bit hill and glen.
And you, you can
stood against him.
My name's Jackley McCaffrey.
Proud Edward's army.
You're always on the same tail. Never fit.
And sent him home.
The Scotland rugby team, the sporting world's greatest pinata.
Do you think again?
Year after year, I'd laugh at the Scottish rugby team, and I'll never be called out. It's an amazing freedom that I have.
Three Scotsmen, it's been that all day, and it's come loose, and Hamish Watson belted it into the sand, and that is it! And 38 years of hurt are over for Scottish rugby!
This felt like the week where the Champions League knockout stages finally took off this season.
Oh, they're back, baby.
Ah, well, according to Ken.
Thanks a lot, Pepe. Pepe's such an idiot.
It was about 20 years ago, those
it
hotkeys.
Was.
Pepe's
was.
Still going strong.
The fact that he's still playing, it's the same Pepe that's playing that Ken slagged off in whatever it was, Euro 2006.
Rory Smith of the New York Times and the Guardian's Nick Ames were on to praise Arsenal and how they qualified for the quarterfinals. But we also talked about Liverpool, who are Champions League bound next season, shorty. Their owners may also be on their way to purchasing other football clubs, something we discussed in depth with Rory and Nick.
I think that their logic is, well, so there's two things. One is that the only way that Liverpool would attempt Michael Edwards back, and this is what Chelsea and Man United, who both tried to sort of explore the idea of employing Michael Edwards, never seem to understand. The two things that are really important to Michael Edwards. One, he doesn't want to be a sporting director again. When he told Chelsea and United that, I don't think it was a negotiating tactic. I think they thought, he's saying that so that we offer him more money. And that was not true. Sometimes in football, problems are not solved by money. it helps, but it doesn't solve problems. Michael Edwards has been sporting director for 10 years, and he looked around and thought, well, I could just keep doing this and I'd get bored intellectually, so why would I want to do that? And the other thing is that I think he felt that his skill set was being used to make a lot of other people, he was well paid, but to make a lot of other people a lot more wealthy than he was. And there was part of him that thought, well, that's not really fair, is it? I'm doing all this work for you and you're the ones who are seeing the equity benefit. And I think he wanted both of those to be addressed. And FSG have found a way around it. One is to put him in charge of their football operations across the group. And I think he probably worked out that was a bit of a pretend job title unless they went out and bought another football team. So that's the kind of Michael Edwards bit. I think that will be, wherever they buy a club, it will be given to Michael Edwards to run as he sees fit. I think it will become a club very much in Michael Edwards' image, in a way that a team as established and as big as Liverpool probably can't ever be. There will always be other competing dynamics there. And the other thing is that their logic is, you know, City doing it, Red Bull are doing it, Chelsea doing it, everyone's doing it, we're going to have to do it to compete. I get that. I think it's a bit grim. I think the whole multi-club ownership thing is far more problematic than certainly UEFA seem to realise. They think it's about competitive integrity. It's not. It's about existential purpose.
What do you mean? But that's a big one, just to drop in there and leave. What do you mean with existential purpose?
That's my style. Come on. It completely changes why a club exists.
About the club that gets owned.
Yeah, the club that gets bought to be a feeder team. It's, you know, when Leipzig and Salzburg played each other in the Europa League a few years ago, there was a big hoo-ha about, you know, the same directors, and UEFA fudged it so that it didn't contravene any rules. Neither Leipzig nor Salzburg were going to do a West Germany against Austria in 1982. It's not going to happen. That if Nice play Man United in the Champions League next year, Nice aren't going to throw the game so that Man United can go through. It just doesn't work like that. I don't think the clubs are operating like that on the sort of level that they'd need to be. The coach, you know, if Jean-Claude Blanc went to whoever, to Farioli, the Nice manager next season, and said, look, you're going to have to chuck this game because we need United in the knockout, Farioli would walk out straight away. It just wouldn't happen, I'm confident in that. The issue is that it turns clubs into something they're not meant to be. Every club is meant to be trying to do its best for itself and for its fans.
No, I agree. But I feel maybe we're skipping ahead a little.
Thing I want to say very quickly.
Yeah.
Is that right? But the big thing with this whole model is it doesn't work. No one's made it work, except for Red Bull, who've got a really specific vision of what it does. And even that only works to a certain level. Just Leipzig, the top of their pyramid, are competing for fourth in the Bundesliga. But City's model doesn't work. None of the stuff that they're talking about has been made to work anywhere. They're all just doing it because each other are doing it.
So City's model doesn't work? I mean,
no, it doesn't work in any way.
The aura of success or invincibility around Manchester City sort of maybe... You just maybe assume it works. The question that I wanted to go back to is, you said, you know, everyone's doing it. City's doing it. Red Bull are doing it. Chelsea are doing it. I mean, okay, first of all, that's not everybody. Secondly, it's like, we're talking about three of the most unpopular projects in football. You know, I mean, there isn't anyone who doesn't support one of those entities that has a good word to say about them. Why would Liverpool do this? Especially when Liverpool makes such a big deal out of sort of being... We're better than this. Doesn't it go massively against their supposed values to do this? And if so, is it one of those things that might... another thing that's gone against the values of Liverpool is ticket price increases, which have been occasionally met with protest, and the club has basically done a U-turn about it. The Super League, there's another U-turn. Is there any chance, is this against Liverpool's values, and is there a chance of another U-turn here?
It's against Liverpool's purported values, yes. It's not against FSG's values. And I take slight issue with the idea that it's just those three that don't. You know, there are UEFA's benchmarking report, I think that had 300 clubs who were part of multi-club groups. Palace have got one, Leicester have got one, Villa have got one, Brighton have got one. The one thing we haven't seen yet is the big European teams doing it. Real, I know, have said that there's only one Real Madrid and it would kind of dilute their potency. Obviously, the German teams can't do it for various reasons. PSG, I'm a bit surprised, haven't tried it. Though they've got, you know, Eupen in Belgium are owned by Qatar as well, so I'm sure there's links. But there are... Monaco had a deal with Circle Bruges for a little bit. Other teams have tried it. So it is much more widespread than just those three projects.
Yeah.
It does go against Liverpool's values. But again, I think it's not against FSG's values and they see it as competitively necessary. I'd take issue with that belief. I think it's wrong.
What's your...
And I don't think it's the sort of thing... Sorry. I don't think it's the sort of thing that Liverpool fans or any big club's fans would feel emotive enough to push back against. It's not like ticket prices or something like that. It doesn't directly pertain to what you see in front of you or how you support your club, does it? It's a sort of ancillary factor that, while not palatable, affects other people, if you see what I mean, which is you know, it's a parochial way of looking at it, but I think that is essentially true. So, you know, you've seen in other cases, such as Chelsea, the protests at Strasbourg and stuff like that, but that's obviously a big storied historic club that is on the end of it. Not a way that I think most of us would agree with whatsoever, but I don't think you've heard Chelsea fans utter too much of a squeak about it. But I do find the framing, and Rory's already referred to this a bit, Edwards said they need to do it to remain competitive, I think was his words. So he's framing it as an existential issue almost for Liverpool themselves. You know, if we don't do this, then, you know, what's the end game? We're going to slide away from the top end of the table of European football or something like that. And when it's framed like that, for me, it's profoundly depressing, because it tells me that this is not going away anytime soon, and it's going to get even bigger. I wouldn't surprise me if Arsenal went down that route at some point as well. They've definitely considered it. I don't know if anything's especially close, but, you know, they've all thought about it. And again, as Rory said, UEFA have not shown anything like the teeth, or I think the understanding, the actual nuanced understanding of the issue, which is a key thing, and this goes to the very top, to do anything about it. And I don't think it's going to change. It's going to get worse.
The only exceptions are that, and I saw someone say this on Twitter the other day, I can't remember who it was, Liverpool should be allowed to buy the team Liverpool in Uruguay. That should be acceptable. And I think there's an Everton in either Chile or Uruguay as well. They should also be allowed to buy them. Those are the only situations. Everton themselves, of course, potentially becoming part of a multi-sport group that's working brilliantly at the moment. 777. Oh, what a success story. What a great model to follow.
Nick, why is it so bad? You both said it's a terrible thing and that UEFA don't understand that. What don't they understand about this growing situation?
I'd allow Nick to speak for himself, but The issue that UEFA have is they look at it, and it's understandable to an extent, as a kind of a threat to the integrity of their competitions. They're worried about what happens if, you know, Man City play Girona. They are worried about that. They think that looks shady. And they are right to an extent in that if football has a kind of problem if people perceive things to be shady, even if they are not. So if Man City play Girona and the result works out for both of them, people will look at that and think, that's probably not above board. It probably would be entirely above board. But the image of it, the optics aren't great. To me, the idea that becoming a feeder team for another team, becoming a sort of ancillary part of an empire, changes fundamentally kind of what a club is for. It's not there to win anymore. It's there to develop players. That, I think, is much more important. And I've never heard anyone at UEFA so much as mention it. I don't think they really consider it. There is a huge amount of shutting stable doors after horses are running free in the paddock going on at UEFA. They seem to have decided we can't stop this. It's another great, you need to get Miguel on for this, but it's another great example of how the kind of structures around football, the hierarchies that exist, aren't equipped to deal with the forces that are buffeting them. The nation states, the oligarchs, the hedge fund kind of tycoons, they are all more sophisticated, more powerful, more craven than UEFA are prepared to deal with. They don't understand the forces that are working upon them.
To hear that conversation in full, sign up now to the World Service for €5 a month plus VAT on secondcaptains.com. Give us the hog horse clip again there, Simon, will you? Yeah, just the little winning up. That is hog horse.
Shoveling shit would be enjoyable, but it is.
Trying to clear up after the Scottish pack is what he's talking about there, and their failure at the breakdown.
The alternative is playing rugby for Scotland, so I suppose it's all relative, really, isn't it? Fun is relative.
All episodes on the World Service are ad free, and you will be supporting independent, member led broadcasting. And you'll hear more of us talking about Scotland. Listen, if you're Scottish, sign up if Ireland get beaten by Scotland the weekend, because you'll definitely enjoy next week.
It's a buzz up when they're out there, firing the pill, ruining the corners.
Yes. Ruin the chorus. No, I'm not even going to do the accent. Who was it again? Telfer?
Out-jump them, out-scrum them, out-rock them, out-drive them, out-tackle
no,
them.
No, it's just some fan that was interviewed for the World Cup game.
That was like a Scottish legend.
No, Simon keeps playing it. And yeah. It really annoyed me the first time I had to look at his face. It's annoyed me every time I've had to listen to his voice. And Simon keeps...
What about the Scotland fans who sing, "We John McGinn,
yeah, Super like legends. John McGinn"? They're all legends. They're great people. But that guy annoys the hell out of me.
Thanks, Murph.
Thank you all.
Bye. Thank you.
We've got McGinn, Super John McGinn. I just don't think you understand. He's Scotsman. He's better than Zidane. We've got Super John McGinn.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off. They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's
world service.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's to persuade that there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.